to episode 9 of Nuggets for Vet Nurses, where we bring you bite-sized pieces of clinically relevant knowledge to help you in your everyday nursing life. I'm Marcus Taylor.
And I'm Esther Fan. From both sides of the equator, we are your show hosts.
We promised you some gutter talk. So this episode reveals some mysteries of the humble Penrose drain. Get it? Gutter, drain.
I'm intrigued already. Let's start by asking, what is a Penrose drain?
A Penrose drain is a flexible rubber or silicone tube which is anchored inside a surgical site and exits through a separate wound. It's used to promote drainage of fluids by gravity. The aim is to prevent seroma formation.
Whoa. A seroma? Aren't things ending in oma usually cancers, like lymphoma or melanoma or osteosarcoma? Are you saying that surgery can end in cancer and drains can prevent that?
Calm the farm. It's not like that. You're right in that many types of cancer end in oma, but oma can also mean swelling, not just tumor, like glaucoma when a drainage is blocked and the eye swells, or an oral hematoma where blood collects in a swelling under the skin of the pinna. A seroma is a collection of serous or clear fluid under the skin when the tissue has been traumatized, usually by surgery, and it can't escape because you did such a good job at stitching it up.
Phew, I see.
If a seroma is small, like we often see around spay wounds, it can self-resolve with time and anti-inflammatories. But the larger they are, the longer they hang around, and the more likely they are to be a breeding ground for bacteria and delay wound healing.
Okay, so they're not cancer bad, but they're bad enough to warrant prevention.
And easy enough to prevent with the Penrose drain, which is like a floppy straw.
So does the fluid from the surgery site come out through the straw, like beer flows on the tap?
No. Contrary to common thought, fluids slide down the smooth sides of the drain, not through the middle of the tube.
Oh, okay. So if even dissecting wounds can form seromas, why don't we see drains hanging out from surgical sites more often?
Drains cause irritation and are a risk of infection since bacteria can track up the drain to the wound. So we only choose to place them in certain situations where there is a lot of dead space. For example, bite wounds or large mass removals that involve a lot of skin flaps.
So I know the floor plan of my house has a living space, but what's dead space again?
Dead space is the potential space between the skin and the underlying tissue, which fluid likes to accumulate in. It can also happen sometimes like between muscles and really bad wounds. Sometimes even the best of surgeons can't tack the skin to the subcutaneous layer as much as I'd like to.
Okay, so when do we take these drains out?
Penrose drains are removed after 3 to 5 days, or when dripping fluid is minimal. Just note, sometimes dripping won't ever stop due to the irritation they cause, but if the fluid is still gushing, they should be left in a bit longer.
And how do we take them out?
Drains are anchored by at least 2 sutures, which should be clearly identifiable. Look for long suture ends, or a different coloured suture, or a lone suture. There will be a suture at each exit hole to stop the drain from retracting into the wound. If it's a single exit drain, there will be another suture anchoring the other end of the drain under the skin. For single exit drains, cut these sutures and gently pull the drain out.
And for double exit drains, do we just cut the sutures too and pull the whole thing out through one side?
No, please don't do that. You'll be pulling one dirty drain end through a clean surgical wound.
Oh yeah.
For double exit drains, you need to remove the anchoring suture from one end, then pull that end gently, i.e. out of the wound a few millimetres. Cut it off as close as you can to the body wall, and then go to the other end, remove the anchoring suture, and pull the whole drain out from there.
Okay, I've got my imaginoscope on, and I think I can understand that. But to clarify, I'm going to head to our Instagram page where you're going to post visuals of this technique.
Yeah, if you imagine like there's a dirty end, you pull it down a little bit, cut the dirty part off, and then go to the other end. Once you remove both sutures, you pull it through, pulling a non-dirty end because you've cut it off through the whole wound. Hopefully that makes sense.
Got it. Anything else to point out?
Well, it's really important to identify the anchor suture. Don't remove sutures in the primary wound unless you want to appease an angry surgeon with home-baked goods.
I remember in my final year radiology rotation, every time we made a mistake, we had to bring some home baking. So it's not hard to imagine that the radiology tea rooms were always overflowing with cakes and biscuits, and that the radiologists were at high risk of developing student-induced diabetes.
The only thing I remember from radiology is we wore, for some reason, fancy clothes. And I don't really know why. It was like a tradition. We wore like dress shoes and a dress shirt. And on my way home, there was a guy trying to rob my house. And I ended up chasing him like through our whole town in my dress clothes, like trying to catch this robber. And it turned into a whole saga with the police. But long story short is he got away.
And your nice clothes got dirty.
They got dirty and sweaty. But I swear, if I was in my running shoes, I would have got them.
Oh, damn that radiology round.
You know. So while the drain is in, the animal should wear a cone to stop them licking it or tearing it out. They should also be separated from other pets who may lick the fluid that drips. And after removal, the exit wound is left to heal on its own. Owners can wipe them with warm water or iodine to keep it clean. And again, keep that cone on until it heals.
Got it.
Well, Esther, I've been doing a lot of talking these last few episodes. I also shared about my adventures in Lapland. I wondered if you wanted to finish us off today with some stories from maybe some other faraway lands.
Well, I'm not sure how far away it is in kilometres, but I think the most faraway land in my mind that I've been to is Mongolia. So I went there as a final year student as part of an externship placement other range through Christian Veterinary Mission. I spent a month with VetNet, which was a local NGO that serves vets and students and farmers. The farmers are called herders, and they also serve teachers as well. So my first task was to prepare continuing educational material on equine neurology.
Equine neurology?
I know, right? Like, I can't believe I agreed to that. Okay, I like horses. I rode and I competed them all through high school, but neuro was and is and forever will be one of my least favourite topics. I don't think I've ever done anything with equine neurology since. But after that, I travelled with a team across the vast countryside to teach and to deliver medications to the local vets and herders. My teaching topic was neonatal diarrhoea in sheep and goats. Now that was something that floated my boat a bit more. I was diligently preparing my PowerPoint of causes of diarrhoea and how to manage them. For example, move all the sick animals into an isolation pen, feed and treat them last, wash your hands and disinfect your gear after handling and before eating and drinking, etc. And then I got to the countryside. So the Mongolian countryside is beautiful, but it's pretty sparse. I soon realized that there were no fences. So sometimes I didn't see a fence for days as we drove and drove and drove. And there were hardly any yards or corrals. Mongolian herders are nomads who live in white gears, or sometimes they're called yurts, and their stock just seemed to stick around, I suppose.
If I were a Mongolian sheep, I'd have wandered off from the get-go.
Yeah, I'd put my money on that you would have done that. But see, as Westerners employ yards and races and crushers and all the farmers' kids to help with weaning and drafting and all that kind of stuff, right? But all the Mongolians have to do is kind of walk through the mob of ewes and lambs, gently swinging a little, well, actually it's a long stock whip, and all the mums run to one side and all the lambs run to the other. The mums are taken away for the day to graze, and then they come home at night to feed their babies. It was really incredible to watch. I reckon there must be some Mongolian magic that we're missing out on.
That's incredible.
Yeah. And then I realized that there was no running water. So we brought our own water from the villages, and the herders also go there to fill up. Sometimes we'd come across a stream and would fill up there too. And it was early spring, so things were dry. In winter, the place is covered with snow, but in summer, they told me, it's lush and green, a bit like New Zealand. So because there was no water at the time, grass was sparse. And if you have no grass, you're not going to have any trees, which means there's no firewood to cook your mutton. So the locals use dried animal dung as fuel for their stoves.
Did you say dung?
Yep. Dung, feces, poos, number twos, whatever you want to call it. That was their readily available carbon source. And so that's what they cooked with. And so there I am trying to teach them to separate out their sickies from their healthy sheep and goats, but there's no fences and no yards. And then I tell them to wash and disinfect, but there's no running water. And then I tell them about zoonotic diseases and food hygiene, but they're bringing poo into their home to cook with. So I don't exactly know if they learned anything useful from my lectures in those few weeks, but I learned so much. I mean, Mongolians are such hardy people, but they're so hospitable. And the experience really opened my eyes and enriched my spirit and my soul. I actually ended up returning 10 years later to serve, but that time it was in the smallies department.
Wow. Do you think that failed lecturing experience is a subconscious motivator for this podcast? Like, so you're wanting to make up for that impractical knowledge you dished out in Mongolia, told them like they were going to get diarrhea and then they're cooking with their poop anyway, that you're over, you know, maybe you're overcompensating by giving heaps of practical tips to these Australians and Kiwis and hopefully nurses all around the world with these nuggets.
Maybe. I'm actually never full of that. I actually recently told VetNet Mongolia about this podcast, so I hope it will be a useful resource for them and maybe redeem myself as a somewhat decent educator. Suppose we'll see. But seriously, nurses, if you have an opportunity or time or even a microscopic interest, I'd encourage you to check out what volunteer or mission work you can get involved in. It's a really great way to give back to our global community, and I'll bet you won't return unchanged.
I second that. Well, nurses, those are the nuggets we have for you today. Don't forget to check us out on Instagram, where we're posting diagrams of how to remove the double end drain and the quiz on identifying the anchoring sutures.
And pictures of our adventures. We'd also love your comments, likes, and shares. We'll catch you next time.
See you next time.